First of all, apologies. I wish I could tell you that I was the world's expert on the subject I'll be talking about, but I'm not. This was a subject that I worked on for a number of years, a few years ago, and tried to look at what I would call phenomenological models of some experiments that were being done in various places on taking simple microorganism systems and doing evolution in the laboratory, monitoring fitnesses, monitoring where possible what genetic changes were contributing to those fitness changes. And our goal was, in some sense, to try to understand a little bit about the statistical models that could be accounting for the data. And you'll hopefully have lots of questions, and probably people in the audience will be able to answer them better than I. So we'll see how this goes. So this was like a challenge that Terry gave to me to give a talk on this. So as I said, this was work I did a number of years ago with collaborators. We were motivated at the time by a set of experiments that was going on at UCSD on viral evolution. But the talk, I'll actually talk about two different systems. So I'll talk about RNA viruses. RNA viruses are viruses where the genetic information is stored in the RNA instead of the DNA. Besides the fact that that's interesting that that occurs in nature, from the point of view of evolution, that's more interesting because the replication machinery typically is much more error-prone in these RNA replications than in the DNA replication. So forgetting about details at the very sort of very general level, if you look at what somebody might tell you a typical error rate is in humans for reproducing DNA, someone might tell you, I don't know how if this is really thought to be tremendously accurate, but it's pretty small. There are lots of machinery around which goes back, checks the DNA as it's reproduced to see if it's been done correctly, excises it, goes, does it again. These RNA viruses have almost none of that, and so the error rates tend to be very large. So you have maybe 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the minus 3 error rates per base. A typical genome might be 10,000 base pairs, so you're getting a couple of errors maybe every time you replicate the genome of these RNA viruses. So originally, we were motivated by some experiments being done at UCSD in a lab run by Holland on a particular RNA virus. So the first part of the talk, I'll tell you about that. I guess tomorrow there's a talk by Lin Chow, who in some sense is the successor in San Diego to those original experiments of Holland, and he'll talk about new experiments on viruses, virus evolution in the laboratory. The other system, which I'm going to talk about, is E. coli. And in particular, there's a group at Michigan State run by Lenski, which has done the heroic task of running, I think they're up to on the order of 25,000 generations of E. coli, where you just grow them in a test tube and monitor various things about them. And you keep doing this year after year, surviving things like power failures in your lab and all sorts of other things. And E. coli, of course, is much more a complicated organism than viruses. It does have error-correcting machinery, which we'll talk about a little bit. And maybe if you need a number for what the error rate might be, it might be 10 to the minus 5. And this is a good organism as long as you're willing to wait the years it takes to get thousands and tens of thousands of generations to look at evolutionary effects. This is a good organism because you can perform sophisticated genetic manipulations and you can do lots of things with E. coli. Yeah. I don't. Why? I don't know. This is the number that typically I see. I mean, I don't know. Is anybody? I don't think it's lower than humans. I mean, maybe per genome or what? Do you have some? Anybody else have any insight into that? Well, yes, Lin Chao. Yeah, I mean. So the Holland. So let me start with the first set of experiments, just to show you what the. Since you all were looking at phylogenetic trees, I figured I would show you one. Not that there's any. So they performed the experiments on a particular virus, vesicular stomatitis virus, which infects animals, which people know quite a lot about its natural distribution. Here is a phylogenetic tree of the different strains of this virus found in the wild, the US and various places in South America, but we're not going to try to understand anything about the evolution of this virus in its natural population, which is of course an interesting subject on its own right. Instead, what was done was to take this virus and use it as a basis for a standard set of laboratory experiments. And the laboratory experiments are, in principle, quite simple. It's you find some set of cells in which the virus can infect and grow. And you have, you know, imagine a box, you know, a tissue culture box of these cells. At the beginning of each day, you inject 10 to the fifth virus particles into this fresh medium, this fresh tissue. You let them grow for, let's say, 24 hours. It's a convenient sort of time to come in the next morning and start again. Each infected cell, each gives rise to a large sort of burst size of viruses. So this 10 to the fifth number goes way up. Maybe to, if this number is right on average, maybe up to 10 to the ninth. At the end of this 24-hour period, you sample that cell, so you remove 10 to the fifth particles from this now much larger population, and you just go to a new box and you start again. And you just do this day after day for as many weeks or months as you actually have patience for. And the idea, of course, is very simple. The idea is that of these 10 to the fifth viruses, there are going to be some variation in their ability to infect cells and in their ability to create progeny. The ones that are very effective at that process are going to be more represented in the larger population at the end of the day than the ones that are less effective. Then when you sample that, you're going to be preferentially sampling ones that are of the higher fitness end of the spectrum of the ones you have. And you keep doing this day after day, and of course, because you keep sampling and taking from the higher end of the population, the average fitness increases in time, and you can monitor what's going on in various ways. So one good thing about the experiment is, after you remove the sample, you have a lot of material sitting around which you can do other tests on, you can measure fitnesses, you can freeze it for further analysis. In principle, although the technology has not yet come to it, in principle you could do real genomics and try to figure out what was actually happening at the level of the genes as correlated with the measurable changes in the growth rates that you're monitoring in the more standard, you know, you put them on a dish and watch how fast it grows type experiments. Okay, so those are the basic experiments that were done in the RNA viruses, and the results, this was just a typical graph that we found. So these experiments were going on at UCSD, as is always the case. It turned out that one of the postdocs working in this lab knew somebody who, you know, in the physics department, and so they sort of said, well, can you help us understand what's going on? So we at least tried to think about it a little bit. And a typical graph for what they would see is logarithm of fitness just means growth rate from the point of view of physics. And what they would typically see would be an initial sort of fairly rapid increase in the fitness and then saturating over a time scale. Now, each of these passages is one day, a 24-hour period, so this is 3 months or so worth of experiment, sort of saturating to what looked like just a linear increase in the fitness as a function of time. And at least over the several month scale that they did the experiment, it looked like it just continued being linear. There was little evidence of saturation. Let me show you some more data. Here's just some more of their graphs that were published. Well, in this case, I don't know if you believe this point or not, but this is their data taken from, you know, wherever their PNAS paper or something, and it doesn't look like it saturates. Certainly in this case, it looks like it's still going up linearly. In this case, certainly, you know, and here, if you would neglect this point, which, okay, you're an experimentalist now, you probably one point shouldn't, you know, it looks like it doesn't saturate. Okay, now, of course, eventually it must saturate, we all believe. You can't have RNA viruses that could reproduce every millisecond. So the question is, you know, I was asked before this talk, is this going to be mostly a biology talk and mostly a physics talk? Well, the answer is it's mostly a physics talk. The reason it's mostly a physics talk is not that I don't want to give mostly a biology talk. I would love to be able to tell you precisely what was going on in the genes of that RNA virus to actually give rise to that rise of fitness. But the answer is there's just very little information available at that level. Hopefully, as time goes, maybe it's gotten better over the last few years when I've been detuned from this subject. But still, the typical evolution experiments done in the laboratory measure fitnesses. They maybe measure something like a mutation rate, which we'll discuss for E. coli, but certainly the technology is not there yet to do detailed mappings of how the genome has changed. There's been some work along those lines in E. coli, but it's still not there. I mean, and that's probably what needs to happen over the next number of years to make these experiments really, you know, even more interesting. So, yeah. It's how big? What? I think it was 11 kb, but that's my memory from 3 years ago. Well, yeah, individually it can be sequenced once, certainly, with no problem. The question is somebody willing to run this sort of experiments and sequence it every day? Or every, you know, and of course, this is a virus, so there's not a, I mean, the whole idea is there's some, as we'll discuss, there's some type of distribution of genomes at any given time. And so it's not even necessarily like one sequencing is enough per day. Maybe you need to measure the distribution as a function of time. So, yeah.
Is it clear that the change that you observe is actually due to genomic changes or just to biased sampling each day?
Well, what does biased sampling mean?
In the sense that you have a distribution of genomes.
Right.
You sample the thicker ones and you sample another subset.
No, so in other words, you sample randomly from the distribution. You just sample randomly. But the idea is that because you let the thing grow from 10 to the 5th to, let's say, 10 to the 9th, the ones that grow faster will be higher. You know, if you start out with, I don't know, with half of them growing at one rate and half of them growing at the other rate, by the time you've multiplied by a lot, it's not going to be half and half anymore. The one that grows faster is going to be 90%.
Sure, that's
right.
What I meant by it. So, but then you mean that genomic changes in individual viruses, or is it this subsequent sampling?
Well,
that
no, it's not. In other words, the virus certainly is changing in terms of how fast it's able to grow. Okay. In other words, it's not a sampling artifact. It's clear that what's happening is this technique in the laboratory of what's called passages of just you let it grow and then you sample and you let it grow and you sample is basically, and then you measure the fitness. So what that procedure will do is it will select the fitter growing members of your population distribution and will amplify their effect. And it's a laboratory, maybe you can help me. What do you mean by an enrichment process? In other words, whether there's really mutation involved in changing the genome or whether then, okay, so then I have to tell you, okay, so then the experiments don't tell you that directly, so I have to tell you we have a model and what we basically suggest is, in terms of that data, the initial rapid rise is just selection and the increase, the linear increase is actually mutation. So that's, okay, so I didn't understand your question, but yeah, so that's, so, yeah. That's what I was afraid. Yeah.
Well, the people at work,
yes.
They actually were able to some extent, explore the historical record.
Yes.
So you could at least, you know, when the technology
right.
becomes available, you could go back and
yeah.
look at it. Is that possible in this case as well?
Yes. Well, the answer is there's no reason in principle why you can't keep the record. In practice, I think the sad story is that when Holland retired and this lab was closed down, I think they basically destroyed all the viral samples. In principle, no, sure. I mean, maybe when Wen Chao, when you ask Wen Chao, presumably he keeps a record of, I mean, there's no reason you can't. And that's certainly for Lenski, that's been extremely valuable to be able to go back and say, you know, what really happened on, you know, in 1993 at April 4th. I mean, so yeah, there's no reason not to. There's no reason why you couldn't do that. Well, but yeah. Months. So each of those, so the scale on the bottom is days. No, it's like 3 months, 4 months for experiment in those experiments, as opposed to the Lenski experiment, which is 5 to 10 years. So that's the advantage of working. What?
I think they're up to like 15 to 20 now.
Yeah, I mean I forget the exact number of generations. At least 25,000.
So it's like 15 years.
Yeah. Okay. So. So let me just tell you, for those of you who've never thought about this subject before at all, a lot of the words you hear when you start talking about evolution and increasing fitness go back to a very very sort of appealing picture that was originally proposed by Wright, I don't know, back in the 30s, I guess, of there being some, what he called a fitness landscape, which means fitness here just means growth rate, and there's some parameters of the genome, presumably, but you know there it was just more general, and as you moved in these parameters, you would get peaks and valleys of fitness, and the population would like to be at the local peaks of fitness, and of course it would like to be increasing its fitness, but perhaps to get from one local peak to another it might have to traverse valleys in between. So the general picture which people have in the back of their mind very often when they're thinking about these experiments is some sort of diffusive motion on a landscape which, you know, has some degree of ruggedness. Okay, that's the general picture. Now, of course, as the system gets more rugged, if so here I've tried to draw a fitness landscape which is sort of slowly sloping upward as you go to the right. So in general, the population would like to be moving up to the right, but on the other hand, you know, it may have to spend some time to get over these sort of low points along the way. Clearly, as the ruggedness increases, the system tends to get trapped for long periods of time in these metastable states. So over here, this is obviously not the overall maximum fitness, which is out here somewhere, but nonetheless, maybe all the typical local changes you make would lead to states nearby that are lower fitness, and those would not be selected. And so if you increase the ruggedness, the dynamics becomes very glassy. You see things that perhaps could be interpreted as punctuated equilibria, which means that you spend a lot of time here, and then over a sort of very fast fluctuation time, you jump to a nearby place. And this is very often the language one thinks about. One point that we had is that looking at the RNA data, we decided that life was simpler than that. We saw no evidence in the RNA virus experiment that one would really have to think hard about these sort of trapping events and glassy dynamics or whatever. It really looked to us, at least at the accuracy of the experimental information, that it looked like a nice linear rise. So if it looks like a nice linear rise, we might as well make our lives easy. Now, again, just for general background, very often, if you're forced to make a model of that type of fitness landscape, the thing that people most and sort of think about originally is a set of models or variations thereof due to Kaufman, which sometimes are called NK models. And the idea is that, well, we're going to approximate the genome perhaps by just some binary string of digits, because it shouldn't matter that at this level we're just interested in general features of moving on these landscapes, so it doesn't matter. So Kaufman proposed you would have a genome that would consist of sort of a binary string of digits, and the fitness would be some function of the genome, and the general function would have a series of higher body terms. So there would be a one body term, which would be just the sum of some number times the value of this gene. So that would be the independent gene approximation, where, you know, each gene acts independently to create some property of the cell, the property of the virus, or the property of the E. coli. If that each gene is assumed to have two different possible states, one which is good, one which is bad, that can be generalized without worrying too, you know, that doesn't matter too much. And the one body term would be the independent gene assumption. Higher body terms, if you start putting in terms in this overall general sum which couple two S's together, would correspond to interactions between genes. So the effect of one particular location would depend on some other location. So these two genes would somehow be coupled. They would have an interaction that this fitness would not be merely given by the sum of these independent contributions from these different pieces of the genome. And you can keep going up and up. So finally, by the time you have a term with all the indices here, it means that, you know, in order to calculate the effect of the, you know, there's a term which requires knowledge of all the different genes before knowing how that enters into the fitness. So the largest, so K in this model, N is sort of the number of different genes in this binary string genome. K is how many of these interactions you keep. K equal 1 means independent genes. K equal N means that each configuration of the genome has an entirely unique fitness. And that's like a random energy model where, you know, you sort of totally, you change one spin up and down and you can completely change the energy of the system. You can no connection whatsoever. And clearly, the bigger K is, the more rugged the landscape. And from what I told you before, the simplest assumption for the RNA virus experiment is that there are no ruggedness effects. And so therefore, one can ask the question, which we did, how far can you get in trying to understand the experiments by sticking with the simplest model? So this is the simplest model, so we're going to stick with the simplest model and just try to see how far we can get in understanding what's going on. Now, recent, of course, has to be renormalized. Recent here means now 1996, I think, or 97. There was an experiment on E. coli that actually tried to test for the presence of the K equal 2 term. So they actually tried to go in and make changes in genes and look at the resulting fitness and try to see if things looked like they were just independent. So you can go in by hand, change the genome, you know, make some mutation by hand, change, you know, gene A, get some measured change in fitness, change gene B, get some measured change in fitness, then change both genes A and gene B and say, okay, was the change in fitness of the double mutant the same as I would have predicted, assuming those genes are acting independently, or is there some interaction between them? So they did that experiment with various pairs of mutants in E. coli, and they actually discovered that there were some evidence for what you would think of in terms of this model, K equal 2 terms, but in fact the sign was random. So in fact they found that it was just as often that the interaction between genes would, you know, so if you had two deleterious genes and now you make the double mutant and you ask, let's say gene 1 makes it 10% less fitness, 10% less rate, gene 2 makes it 10% less rate, you put both of them in there and you say, okay, is the rate now, you know, more or less than I would have predicted based on just multiplying those two things together? And the answer is sometimes it was more and sometimes it was less. So they saw evidence of interactions between genes, but there was no definite sign of the effect in their experimental results. Yes? Walensky did that in E. coli. And there was a paper, I guess, around 96 or 97, which discussed that. So, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not saying it's surprising. I'm just saying that, you know. Okay, I'm just saying, so in E. coli, so I didn't mean to imply that there were entire terms. What I'm saying is that it's, you know, the problem with this framework is you can, until experiments like that are done, you can assume what you want. And Lenski's experiment was a valiant attempt to really try to figure out if something like a K equal 2 term is present or not present in the E. coli genome. So in the RNA virus, we don't know, because no one did that experiment. In E. coli, there's certainly evidence for K equal 2, and I don't know whether there's been any subsequent work in that direction. So perhaps it's what you would have expected. As you say, if it would have been all of one sign or the other, then that would have implied a certain deterministic shape for this landscape that maybe isn't there. The reason they did the experiment, just as an aside, for those of you who, you know, there is a prediction having to do with, now the name is Kondrashev, is that the name? Kondrashev, that having to do with the usefulness or non-usefulness of recombination of genomes based on whether there's basically based on whether there's positive reinforcement or negative reinforcement of deleterious genes. So the argument is whether recombination will lower your mutational load or not. So they were actually testing that. They didn't go in and say, we're going to test the K equal 2 term in the Kaufman model. They were actually trying to relate it to a prediction based on about recombination of genomes due to Kondrashev. But nonetheless, it was a good, you know, it's an interesting result that there is, that certainly are higher order interactions. So that, right. Oh, sure, sure. No, of course. But this is sort of, yeah, I mean, this is done sort of almost at a random, in other words, that's for a specific case. Surely, you know, if you have, I don't know, you know, two pieces that are doing the same biological task, and you can clearly compensate for one thing by the other thing. Here it was sort of more random. It's you just pick a random mutation in some gene, you pick another random mutation, and you don't, so you're far away from any functional, functional complementation that you would have naturally expected based on, you know, really thinking about the biology. It's just two random mutations, and the question is whether those things seem to be totally independent of each other or whether there's some evidence of interaction. Yeah, okay, right. No, so, okay. How strong? How common? How? Now you expect. Now I have to remember. Is the problem? My impression is that it was sort of. It was sort of the, you know, in some sense in between. In other words, it wasn't negligible, but it wasn't so large to totally swamp the idea that there would be any validity of the, you know, and so that was my trying to remember, but I remember there's a graph in their paper of, I think I may even have it somewhere, of the sort of distribution of these things, and it's some, you know, some distribution with, so it certainly would be quantitatively important, but probably at least the two-body term, if one had to guess, wouldn't totally dominate everything. At least that's a guess. Yeah.
If you have one mutation where you take 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5, yeah. And the population is 10 to the 5, maybe you don't give a chance a double mutation per year.
Well, so yeah, so we'll talk about, in the model, we can talk about. Well, no, but it's not, it's not only a question of how would the double mute, it's a question also of saying, what information do you need to know in order to evaluate whether this mutant is better in fitness than in this fitness? In the independent gene model, you need to know no other information about the genome of the system. This particular gene over here has, let's say in this approximation, a deleterious allele and a good allele, and you don't need to know anything else about the genome to know how much mutating that one particular gene is going to affect your fitness. If they're k equal 2 terms, it means that in order to evaluate if that fitness change is, you know, how good or bad it is to flip that gene, you need to know everything else about the genetic background, at least at the point of, so it's not just a question of evaluating the, you know, double mutants, it's also a question of how much you need to know about evaluating even single mutants.
I guess my point is, yeah, it's not clear how good that experiment is for actually getting at the higher K term.
I agree, yeah.
Like a genome where every gene has sort of a threefold redundancy, so three pathways, but there's obviously some kind of K equal 2 term, but nevertheless, picking out of one of these pairs, the chance would be one of the genomes.
Okay, so, I mean, you can, so, our perspective was a phenomenological one. I mean, I'm not usually a phenomenologist, so, it makes me nervous to say that our perspective was not to ask the question of what would have been the best experimental design to figure out what the real genetic interactions were. Our perspective was, I said, the perspective that usually makes me very uncomfortable is the perspective of saying, here is the data, this is what we did, you know, can we try to make a model which at least begins to help us understand what's going on? And then we can think about what issues come up in the modeling to, you know, that the sort of physics, statistical physics issues. So I said, it's usually the opposite role from what I try to do in other subjects, but here we really played the role of sort of phenomenology, of just trying to say, from the perspective that we were looking at the data, we saw no evidence that we needed to think very carefully about these higher order terms, and so we didn't. And that's just what we did. And I'm not saying it shouldn't be thought about, that's just what we did. No, I don't think so. It wasn't designed, that wasn't the design criteria. The experiment was designed very carefully to eliminate predator-prey type interaction. So it's purely a race. That was what drives the experimental design. In other words, if you do evolution in the wild, you have not only mutations competing to fitness, but you also have, you know, co-evolution, I guess is the official word. You also have, you know, species-species interactions and competition and a lot. These experiments are designed to explicitly get rid of that. So you have enough room, enough space for every virus to reproduce at whatever it's fast, however fast it can do it. That's what drives the design of these experiments, not the desire to eliminate higher order genetic interactions. I mean, it may be true anyway that you get that effectively you don't have those, but it wasn't designed that way. Yeah. Right. You still have to evaluate each in single. Yeah.
But I think what Debbie is saying is that if the individual organism is going to go through one point mutation dies out as a result of the mutation being
a single mutation can be unfavorable.
Yeah, double mutation can be.
It has no chance.
Yeah, but then you wouldn't see this. Then you wouldn't see this constant increase in fitness if that were the case. I mean, in other words, if.
No, but you see the ones which are optimized on a single mutation level, but not the ones on a double mutation. That happens on
many. It depends on. It depends on the. Okay. No, I mean, that's it. Okay, so.
Just one point of clarification.
Yes.
The evidence for or against the spreading landscape, as you're pointing to, though, is how smooth this curve is.
Right. Yeah, that's it.
That was actually seen with E. coli as well.
And the E. coli curve looks smooth also, although...
It's a highly average quantity.
Sure, of course.
So it's not clear that you don't have, you know, it's level of... It's closer to level
of
individual.
So yeah, sure. No, that's why I keep apologizing for doing phenomenology, which is that this doesn't rule out... In other words,
I mean, if you go to smaller and smaller sample sizes, you presumably see a more rugged
structure. Right. But even if you, if you go to a smaller and smaller sample size, you see randomness, even if you have a perfectly smooth landscape, because there's still a probability distribution of when you make the next jump.
Right.
So in other words, it's hard to disentangle. You know, in other words, the point of having a very rugged thing is that even with a very large population size, you should see metastable states, because you should get trapped in a metastable state, which requires a rare fluctuation, even with a large population size, to get you over to the next hill, and that's what's just really was not seen in that RNA data, and. Okay, I mean, yeah. Well, neutral wouldn't show up at all here, right? Because we're only measuring fitness. Right, so there's no information. I mean, there's no information about, you know, what you'd want to do is you'd want to monitor the genome at the same, you know, you want to see, okay, you know, how different are the genomes and, okay, you know. That's it. Okay, anyway, so finally, we can get down to physics for this problem. We'll return to biology when we get back to the E. coli problem. So the model we actually studied was really very simple. So it's, you know, here's the model. You have a number of individuals. Each individual has some birth rate. So birth rate means it just divides and reproduces somebody with its own genome. A genome is exactly this, you know, string of zeros and ones. Every time you reproduce, each of the babies or, you know, can flip one gene with probability mu, or you can, you know, have... And unlike the experiments which have this sort of daily, you know, ebb and wane of it grows and then you sample, it grows and then it sample, we decided to just do the growing and sampling immediately. So every time somebody reproduces, you kill one person at random in the population to maintain an absolutely fixed number. And we don't think this makes a difference. This is easier to analyze, but we don't think it matters if you would let this thing grow to... It's hard to know for sure. I mean, of course, you know, if you try to compare this in a quantitative sense, you know, it might suffer, but you can do the other one too. Certainly in simulations you can do either one, and this is easier to analyze, so we did this. Now, so, I mean...
The
cells they actually grow in?
Yeah.
No, it's not bacteria. It's some mammalian tissue culture or something.
Okay, but it's something that the virus has never seen before.
It's something, yeah. It's something that they don't, yeah. Yeah, they're right. And also, in the experiments, they do various tricks to lower the initial fitnesses. So sometimes they take just wild type, sometimes they take wild type and put it through genetic bottlenecks, which means they choose like one virus out of things. So they try to start out with low fitness and watch it evolve. Sometimes they do that. Whatever that means for a virus. I mean, it's, in other words, you start from a single, you know, toothpick or whatever. So if that's what you mean, then yes. You know. In these experiments. So I mean, that's just the. It can be a broad distribution. That's why the answer to your question is no. There's no reason to believe you start out with a unique. In fact, our interpretation of the... So let me first just you know, show you what the model does, which obviously it's going to do what the experiments did, otherwise I wouldn't have been publishing it. But then I want to talk about the analysis, which is much more interesting. I mean, getting it to agree with the experiments is basically trivial because we were just looking for a model to agree with the experiments. But, and as I said, the interpretation of this graph, this is now just a simulation graph, the interpretation of this is that, unlike what Terry just said, you don't start out with a unique genome, you start out with some spread of genomes, so there's a short time scale in which you just select the best genome you have out of your initial distribution, and just that one grows. So that's purely pure selection from existing genetic materials. Eventually, you run out of variation from that. This is the best you had, and then this part of the graph, this linear increase, is due to mutation in the model, and therefore we assume in the experiment. And there's some parameters, and I'm going to talk about analyzing results like this, in particular analyzing this part over here. Well, in this simplest model, we don't have a saturation. I mean, you can put a saturation in very easily, but we don't have a saturation in that model, and we don't have any ruggedness. Yeah, so in fact, we did that in the limit where the genome was infinitely long. But you can do either one. I mean, I'll talk about saturation effects, So you can do either one. In the computer, you actually can simulate the system where you have an infinitely long genome, or you could do a finite length genome, in which case you automatically have saturation when, as you said, all the spins are up. Oh, okay, so maybe that, okay, so David is right and I'm wrong. Okay, but you're not near 200. Anyway, so let's talk about how you analyze these things, because this is really the physics part. So there's a standard approach to evolution, which goes under the name of the Eigen-Schuster equations. It's basically mean field theory in a different language, or in another language, it's the same thing you do when you go from the chemical kinetics of individual molecules reactions when you go to reaction diffusion equations. So the answer is you write down some set of equations which don't keep track of individuals. You just keep track of population averages. So in particular, what happens, so in this case, what you would say is, I have some number of people in the population at fitness X at time T. And I ask, how does that change in time? So this is a sort of a mean field object. It's not keeping track of the individual configuration of all the people in the population. It's just saying, what is the number of people with this fitness at time t? And there are three processes that I told you about. One process is births. So birth means that at rate that's proportional to this independent variable x, you give birth. So that corresponds to an increase in the number of people at fitness x. You die. And the dying is random. So the dying is not biased by the fitness. The dying is random. And clearly, in order to maintain the constraint of overall fixed population, this thing gets adjusted dynamically to the mean value of x. Because then if I would integrate this thing over all x, then those two terms would cancel. And I'd have no net growth of the population. So this is biased birth, unbiased death. And then, of course, I have mutation. Mutation corresponds to flipping one of these spins, which increases or decreases the fitness. So mutation gets me from fitness X to fitness X plus 1. So in terms of this system, what it says is that if I start out at X minus 1, I can reproduce proportional to a rate X minus 1. There should be a mutation rate up here, mu. It's missing in this equation. Multiply that by the mutation rate, and that will change the X minus 1 to an X, and that will increase the population at X. Similarly, I can mutate downward from X plus 1, and that would correspond to X plus 1 giving birth, and then mutating back down to fitness X, and then I have the term, which, you know, I can mutate out of my current state, so I give birth at X and I mutate out of my current state, and this equation then becomes an equation for this population, which is the analog of what Eigenschuster would tell you to do for an evolution problem. And the problem with this equation is that it doesn't work. Now, what I mean by it doesn't work is this equation is simple enough that you can actually solve it exactly. But I won't tell you the details. But what actually happens is you get a population, which, so now this is just what the solution of this thing looks like. You have some population, and here you have a sort of tail end. These are the most fit members at any given time. And of course, the most fit members grow very fast. And the problem is that with this X term over here, the people at the leading edge grow exponentially faster and faster due to this X times P of X. And what you discover is that this tail over here, I said this is a model that does not have a saturation. So in fact, this tail diverges to infinity at a finite amount of time. So in a finite amount of time, you actually get, and actually the mean diverges also. It's not just that a little subtail diverges, which you might neglect. In fact, the mean of the population diverges to the mean fitness of the population diverges to infinity at a finite time. So this is clearly crazy. And it's because somehow something is going wrong right at the edge over here. And the problem is that you have these individuals that in this continuum approximation, neglecting individuality, there's sort of very rapid growth out here. And in the real process, of course, eventually there's just no one out here. And you really have to wait to put someone out there. In this continual approximation, there's always a sort of long exponential tail, which then exponentially grows more quickly and just leads to this finite time singularity. So from a mathematical perspective, this equation cannot be describing what's going on in the system, even in the limit of having a very, very large number of people. Okay, so usually when we do reaction diffusion equations or mean field theories, we say it will get better and better as the number of people in the population gets larger and larger. Here, this is not true. No matter how many people you have in the population, the mean field theory just gives you the wrong answer. No, it doesn't depend on initial conditions. No. The continuum equation will grow the tail for you. You can start out with compact support in the differential, in that equation, and it's independent of initial conditions. This divergence in finite time is independent of initial conditions. So, okay, so then we'll talk about, okay, yeah, yes, Boris. Yeah.
So
right. Are you thinking that X should? In this model, it says that X will be improved by 1 independent of X, right? Now, well, okay. What assumption would cure this behavior? Yes. That's the equilibrium solution. That's the equilibrium solution. Okay, this is not an equilibrium solution. We're not asking about what?
Assumes about the space of state.
Right.
A very particular structure which is bound to this kind of particle here. But
yes.
The model, the way Eigenschuster have formulated, it would not have this.
No, I mean, you can't have it both ways. If you have a Markov process, you can formally speaking, derive what the mean field theory limit would be, assuming that that fluctuations are not important. You can write down the equations for the mean, assuming that fluctuations are unimportant, and you get that equation for the model I wrote down. Now, maybe the model is wrong, but...
You can write it also for the probability to use, and in
fact, write what for the probability distributions?
You can, in place of writing from the average, you can actually...
Yeah. I mean, I'll tell you this. I mean, there is a... I mean... So far, all I've said is that for this model, the simplest thing you would do to write down a mean field description doesn't work. Now, okay, so then there are two questions. First of all, is this an artifact of the model? Right? If for a general model, mean field theory done this way would be okay, and this is just an artifact of the model that I wrote down. Now, so Boris, you had some additional comment? I was going to try to discuss your point more. Yeah. Yes. Hold on. So let me show you the other. No. No. So okay. No, so let me show you a different graph. Maybe that'll help. Here is a graph now of the... So this is now a model with saturation. The diverging to finite time is obviously... So this is now a model with saturation. This is just exactly the model. So this is now a graph of the... I think it's the mean fitness. There's a total... The maximum allowed fitness is 200 in this model, and this is now the time course of how the fitness increases in simulations for finite population size versus the mean field theory. Okay? So, I mean, it depends what you mean. So, there's a difference in this model between what the mean field theory predicts in terms of how fast it gets to the maximum fitness. Compared to what a finite n calculation does in this system. Now, that may or may not be real in the real world, but it's real in the model. In the model, the mean field theory gives you the wrong answer. It doesn't just give you a finite time singularity when the simulation gives you a constant velocity, which is what I was going to say, but also if you do have a saturation, it completely mispredicts how long it takes you to get to the saturation. So in other words, yeah, I mean, mean field theory is strictly valid for an infinite population, but usually when we have, 10 to the 6th or 10 to the, certainly when we have 10 to the 23rd, we always believe mean field theory. We always, I mean, most, but anyway, I'm not saying that mean field theory has to give the right answer. It clearly doesn't. What I'm saying is that the first thing you would try, that if you try to analyze it in mean field theory, you get the wrong answer. So you've got to do something else. And I hopefully will get to the something else very quickly. Yeah.
I'm just trying to understand it.
Yeah.
How it's related to something like velocity. Is this the same point as the point of Solomon?
I don't know.
If the duality is very important in biology, both individuals and quantized.
Well, it's certainly the same effect in general.
So you cannot look at a continuous approximation.
So what my point is that in systems where the overall behavior of the population is being driven by a small subset of the population, the leading edge of the tail of most fit individuals, there is no way you can possibly get that effect right by some mean field description which does not deal with the individuality of those people at the leading edge, independent of how big the overall population is.
So it sounds like the same.
Yeah, I think it's the same. I don't know what he said, but at least, I mean, discreteness, yeah. So discreteness is important in many cases, and here is one case where it's important. Because no matter how big the population is, the actual time evolution is controlled by a few individuals at the leading edge. Okay, now, Now, I'm not sure what you mean by I can renormalize time. I mean, in other words, I don't think it's valid to say you could match the mean field theory to the experiment, because the mean field theory doesn't agree with the model itself for any finite population size. So, what?
I'm not rejecting it.
Okay.
The statement that the leading edge is always on the sample, and therefore,
but sometimes the leading edge doesn't matter. But it has to be a process whereby the leading edge is driving what's going on. If the leading edge is not what's driving what's going on, then the fact that it's undersampled is irrelevant. Right. Okay. Now, you're asking, can I make another model where it's less important? So, for example, let's say we don't discuss evolution, we discuss what I would call breeding. So what is breeding? Where you're growing your cattle in the field and you come in and decide that you'd like the ones that give more milk or something, or have better tasting beef. And what you go in and you say, at each generation, I'm going to just allow only the top half of the population to reproduce, okay, and not the bottom half. Okay, so that's breeding. It's not the same as where the further out you go, the faster you reproduce. It's that if you're in the top half of the population, you get to reproduce. If you're in the bottom half of the population, you don't get to reproduce. Well, that's a case which is sort of marginal. It's controlled by the leading edge in a sort of weak sense. So in fact, the mean field theory has a solution. And then there are anomalous corrections, which Bernard Derriduck can tell you all about, because that's an edge which is, that's a front which is sort of marginally being pulled along by the leading edge. Here it's worse than that. Here, because of the further out you go, the faster it grows, in fact, the whole thing is dominated by the leading edge, and it just makes no sense at all.
If it's true in experiment, I wouldn't you think that if you double the population size in the experiment, that the increase...
Well, you certainly would see that, but that's predict. But I haven't told you yet what the theory predicts, because all I've told you so far is that the theory for finite population size can't be analyzed with mean field theory. So I haven't told you yet what the theory actually predicts. Of course, it is going to be the case that the fitness rate is going to depend on the population size.
You have made a statement from the theory saying it's sort of the divergent is slightly higher n, so it's dominated by K effects.
Right.
So then I would conclude that we should see that in experiment.
You should certainly see that, yeah, right. Sure. Did they do it? No. But I think I don't think anybody would be surprised that. I mean, I think.
Some people did do that because
yeah. Oh yeah, sure. If you do very small bottlenecks, then of course you lower the fitness. So yeah, you see the opposite end. If you put it through bottlenecks where you try to get a few viruses out, then of course you lower the fitness.
And you can change from going up
to
going down.
Yeah, as the size of the bottleneck, right. So maybe you're right, maybe they did do that.
In fact, earlier in this program I heard from your colleague from San Diego, Chris Wills, that the human population showed there's evidence of bottleneck.
Uh-huh.
Humans almost went extinct at one point.
Okay, that's interesting. No, yeah, so you're right. I mean, there is evidence, at least at the lower end of N, that, they didn't show that, you know, if they did the same experiment but started with a different number, they would get a large different slope. But at the bottom end, in fact, you can get, in fact, when I answered the question before, which said that very often initially in the experiments, they created samples that were lower than wild-type fitness, they did it via this bottlenecking procedure where they would pass it through passages with very small N. And that would actually lower the fitness. So,
as a theoretical basis, the actual question for me to ask is whether discreteness can be treated perturbatively, like, you know, one of the.
Well, that's part of the reason why. Well, okay. So, the answer is no in this case. Well, I'll give you, I mean, you, well, I'll, so let me tell you how you can analyze it, and then you can answer your question. Let me, there's one more question, and yes, Maron.
Yeah, just to find out to who differentiate.
Yeah, so we did that. I mean, if you want to read the paper, we solved it exactly for n equal 2 and looked at that case. I won't, because we'll be here forever if I try to present that details. I'll just give you the general argument that just gets the asymptotic slope right, and you can see directly what the failing is of the mean field approximation, and then you can answer your question if that's somehow treated perturbatively. So you can do exactly what Meron just said. In fact, one of the in this work that we published on this, we went through and we actually solved it exactly for n equal 2 and tried to understand the general structure of what was going on. But let me just go through two more transparencies and then we'll have a 5-minute break. Because then I'm basically finished, then we can go talk about the E. coli separately. So let me just finish this one thing and then we can have a break. So if you want to know, so let's say you're not interested in the full-time development. Let's say you want to know just, and again, this is the limit of the infinite genome. You want to know just the constant velocity slope of the problem. And I already told you that mean field theory, you don't get a constant velocity. You get something which diverges to infinity. So you can do this. Actually, it turns out that this model is sufficiently simple that you can actually derive that exactly. And the way you can do it is by looking at moments of the population. So for example, you can look at the equation that x bar obeys. So if you look at what is the time rate of change of the mean fitness, well, okay, it's a simple calculation to figure out what that does. Mutation doesn't contribute because things can mutate directly up or down, so it averages away. You just get selection, and what selection does is it clearly changes the X bar term, and what you wind up with after a two-line calculation is a result well known to Fisher that the change in the mean population is related to the variance of the population. Okay, that's quite a well-known result. But then the important result is you can then go on and derive an equation for the variance. So this is now the variance of the population. You can look at the time rate of change. Now, of course, mutation does increase the variance of the population. There are higher order terms, sort of third order moments here. But the interesting thing about this problem is you can argue that in the long time limit, these higher order terms become lower order in time. So you can argue, in fact, that this term is a decreasing function of time. And in fact, not only is this term a decreasing function of time, but actually you're also allowed to factor this thing because the connected part of that correlation function also turns out to be something you can prove or argue at least is a decreasing function of time. Once you're left with that, then in fact you're left with a closed set of, you know, equations for the mean and the variance of the population, which of course you can immediately solve. This thing just tells you what the variance is in terms of n mu, and then you can plug it into the other equation and get the linear rate of increase of mean fitness. And you can test this numerically, you can test the factorization, you can test all these things. But the interesting thing about this calculation is that, of course, this term, the term that says that the mutation rate increases the variance, is a term that would be present in the mean field theory. If you took the moments of the mean field equation, not the moments of the actual stochastic process, you of course would get this term also. But this term over here you don't get. This term over here is a term that says there's a reduction in the variance due to something to some correlation term between the mean and the correlation. And what this term is really is the statement that birth and death processes limit the variation. And this is, you know, this point has been made in a variety of papers in a variety of places. It's certainly made in a paper by Zhang in the early 90s at least. And the logic is very simple. The logic is when you give birth to someone who is equivalent to someone you already have in the population, and then you kill someone else at random. So the net effect of a birth-death process like that is actually to reduce the variance of the population. Now you might say, okay, that's trivial. The point is that that's actually proportional, if you work out the details, to 1 over the population size. It's not there in the mean field theory, as it shouldn't be, because the mean field theory is a formal expansion in 1 over n, leading term, but yet this term is what actually limits the growth of the variance. So in the mean field theory, the variance keeps growing along with the mean, along with everything else. In the actual stochastic process, this term limits the growth of the variance. It gets to be size n mu and then stops. And then that feeds back and gives rise to constant velocity in the other term. So now, could you derive that perturbatively? Probably not, is my basic answer. Somehow there's an intrinsic effect due to fluctuations in creating a limitation of the variance that just is not possible to see in the mean field description of this process. Now, of course, it's hard to prove that you can't do it some other way, but yes, Tony.
Have you also explained why you can still see
Have I explained it here? No. Have I explained it in the paper we wrote 4 years ago? Yes.
Because that's obviously key, because the
right.
thing you're doing is very typical in physics.
Right. No, but you can rigorous, at long time, you can argue. It's not ad hoc throwing away. You can actually throw it away because it's lower order in time. Yes, you can actually go through and create an argument that says that and then actually check that numerically. No, because I don't even remember. Because, you know. Yeah, that was the problem with giving this talk, is that I, of course, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, I would know precisely, and now I just don't even remember anymore. Sure. Right. Oh yeah, sure. The master equation is right. I mean, the master equation is an exact description of the stochastic process, so by definition, it's right. And you can derive this directly from the master, whichever way you want. And the physics is that birth-death processes have an intrinsic limitation in the growth of the variance that is not visible in a too naive a treatment. I don't mean to make.
It also turns out that the stochastic character of the growth curve.
Yes.
The little fluctuation, the microscopic ruggedness.
Yes.
Which you argue as not important, in fact, I quite dominate in the future, which affects the entire
Well, no, hold on. You might say it affects the dynamics of the real experimental system, in which case, but it can't affect the dynamics of my system because my system is a model system. I've defined it to be what it is. No. I'm solving it exactly. I can exactly solve the model I wrote down in the long time limit to find the constant velocity rate. Okay, I can't solve it exactly for arbitrary time. I can solve it for two particles for arbitrary times, and I can see the entire time development of the system. But for arbitrary n, I can't solve it exactly, but I can find the asymptotic state, I claim exactly. And I can try to recover the exact argument as to why these higher order correlations are negligible. I guess I have to go back and look at my own paper and figure it out again. But within this model, this is what it does. You know, whether the model is right, I mean, it's you know.
Yeah.
No, a model is a Markov process.
No.
No, let me state it quite precisely. Our basic model is a Markov process of n individuals with genomes that have rules as how those genomes change. They mutate, they give birth, biased by the fitness. The fitness is just the number of ones in their genome, and when they give birth, they can mutate, and they die at random to keep the population size fixed. That's the model. We can analyze the long-time behavior of that model exactly, with no approximations, with some technical arguments that we have to make that whether they're rigorous or not, we don't know, but in any case, can be checked directly numerically. So we have some arguments as to why those terms scale in lower powers of time than the terms I kept. You know, those, you know, are heuristic arguments that can be checked numerically, and it all works. We can predict the velocity, it agrees with the simulations, and it's the answer for this model. What the model has to do with reality is a separate question. What I tried to show you is that if you try to analyze this model in a differential equation setting, in this mean field equation setting, then you don't get the right answer. But this now does not assume that. This now is just based on the exact Markov process that I wrote down. Maybe now's a good time for a break. And then, boy, it's hard work.